Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Smithsonian Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I'm reading from the January-February 2025 issue of the Smithsonian Magazine. I'm going to start today's broadcast finishing an article I started during the last broadcast. That would have been the January 25th, 2025 broadcast of the Smithsonian. If you'd like to access that program, I can tell you how to do that at the end of the program. The title of the article is The Sailboat and the Storm. This is the untold story of the civilian fleet that patrolled American waters during World War II, and the frantic search for the Zeta, a volunteer vessel lost in a ferocious nor'easter. It's by David Wolman and Julian Smith. And here's where we left off. By the next morning, the Zeta had been at sea for 2 weeks in the heart of winter. The men slept only intermittently and ate dwindling rations of beans, rice, and canned peaches. They had resorted to tearing out cabinets and other non-critical parts of the cabin to burn in the stove to stay warm. The cumulative stress and calorie shortage were taking their toll. At one point, Arnal ordered Koskinen to go aloft to affix the repaired sail into place. Koskinen responded that it couldn't be done. He was too exhausted. When Arnal pressed, Koskinen got halfway up the mast before stopping and retreating back down to the deck. "Too weak," he said. 3 days later, hope returned. The Zeta was riding 40-foot waves about 300 miles east of Norfolk, Virginia, when the crew spotted a small Allied warship less than a mile away, heading straight for them. A larger destroyer appeared next. It's a miracle the Zeta wasn't immediately blown out of the water. The destroyer initially mistook the wounded sailboat for a U-boat and sounded battle stations before realizing it was the lost picket force yacht. The nine men rejoiced, but once again their relief was premature. The seas were too heavy for the much larger ships to get close enough to take the men aboard without smashing the sailboat. Moreover, it turned out the ships, escorting a convoy of freighters and tankers to support Allied campaigns in North Africa, were heading in the opposite direction, so towing was out of the question. And because the convoy had to maintain radio silence, the captain of the destroyer couldn't tell anyone. He had found the boat that the whole world seemed to be looking for, but he couldn't do anything to help. For the next few hours, the wind pushed the sailboat like a child's toy between two lines of convoy ships. At times, the vessels were close enough that the crews could see each other's faces, but all they could do was wave. The last Morse-coded message from the destroyer was simply, "Good luck." Then the convoy faded into the fog. Once again, the Zeta was alone in the Atlantic, driven out to sea by storm after storm. The days and nights started to blur. Theodore Carlson, the taxi driver from Brooklyn, comforted himself by reading the Bible. The crew daydreamed about steakhouses in Manhattan, as their rations shrank to a single cup of whatever was left per day. Their faces grew gaunt, and their bodies weakened. Jobson, the college sophomore, fainted on deck, and Ward Weimar, the Dartmouth student, became too feeble to handle the wheel. Tensions aboard the yacht edged toward a breaking point. One afternoon, after Arnal and Smith had argued over their latest point of friction, Arnell sat down in the cabin and took out his 38 caliber pistol, which he began cleaning in silence. When Smith stepped below deck and saw what Arnell was doing, he proceeded to take out his own gun, a 45, and started cleaning it as well. Nobody said a word, and the incident passed. Aware of his own short temper and afraid of doing something regrettable, Smith later asked Choate to hide his gun and never tell him where it was. Smith was on watch the night of December 22nd when he glimpsed a flash of color through the gloom, a red buoy, and the first sign of land in almost a month. Suddenly, the dark shape of a Coast Guard patrol boat loomed barely 100 feet away. The men yelled and waved a flashlight, but the other vessel didn't respond or change course. In desperation, Smith took out the Zeta's automatic rifle and fired half a dozen tracer bullets over the other ship's bow. Unsurprisingly, the crew of the patrol boat thought they were under fire from a German submarine. They were maneuvering into attack position, guns ready, when they heard shouts in English. The ships drew close enough to identify each other. The Zeta's crew finally learned where they were, off Cape Hatteras in North Carolina's Outer Banks, and on the edge of a minefield. In geographic terms, the Zeta was essentially home, but because of the minefield, the boat was in more danger than ever. The Navy ordered the crew to stay put. The next morning, under windless skies, the Zeta's crew members, desperate to reach land and close to starvation, debated running the boat up on the beach, minefield or not. A silent tension hung in the air. Then a blimp appeared, and their excitement spilled forth in hugs, shouts, and laughter. Gathered on deck, the crew members waved and shouted with excitement. The blimp reported back to base. Six men observed on deck, all gesturing wildly for food, and lowered a package of emergency supplies on a line. When the crew brought it on board, they found raisins, chocolate bars, and a note. "Your position reported. Sit tight. Help on way." Within an hour, nine rescue planes had appeared. A Coast Guard patrol boat pulled alongside, and the Zeta's crew climbed aboard, where pots of beef stew were waiting in the galley. Then a heavy fog rolled in, forcing the crew to spend one last night on the water until conditions improved enough to tow the Zeta through the minefield and back to shore. They landed at the hamlet of Ocracoke, North Carolina, on the morning of December 24th. Hundreds of people lined the dock and nearby roads to welcome them. The bedraggled crew quickly boarded a plane to a naval air station in Brooklyn, where their family members were waiting, including Smith's pregnant wife. Some had been grieving their loved ones, convinced they had been lost at sea. Others had clung stubbornly to hope. The men who stepped off the plane were sunburned, skinny, and traumatized from their month-long, nearly 3,000-mile saga. The mood at the reunion was not festive. There was no shouting or laughing, just handshakes, quiet embraces, and a hurried effort by the military to get everybody home in time for Christmas. During the following year, the Navy built more capable patrol vessels, and German submarines shifted their attention to operations farther from America's shores. U-boat captains learned they could no longer attack with impunity up and down the eastern seaboard. As the threat from submarines decreased, the coastal picket force was reduced by two-thirds, and it was discontinued at the end of the war. Miraculously, only one member of the Hooligan Navy was killed while serving during a collision with a Dutch freighter. In a letter to the Greenport Picket Force's commanding officer, a Navy official applauded the civilian sailors' superb brand of seamanship. "I will not go so far as to say our pickets go hunting for gales, but when the gales do come along, these sturdy little boats just take the storms as a matter of course and ride them out." Newspaper accounts praised the Hooligan Navy as iron men in wooden ships, but most Americans were understandably focused on the wars being fought in Europe and the Pacific. The fleet's military impact on the Battle of the Atlantic remains an open question. There are no accounts of U-boats sunk directly because of a patrol boat sighting. But Robert Desch, a Coast Guard historian, says the Germans were forced to change their tactics after the picket force became operational. The presence of so many small craft limited the Germans' ability to hunt, while reassuring merchant seamen that if they were targeted, an American craft would be there to scoop them up out of the water. It certainly had an influence on what the Germans were doing, he says. John Wilbur, an independent researcher who has studied the coastal picket force for decades, offers a comparison with American submarine activity in the waters off Japan a few years later. "The American subs were very wary of small coastal craft," he says. "Perhaps they were not the perfect answer, but sailboats were the best solution available in 1942 and 1943. Despite everything the Zeta's crew went through, most served through the end of the war. Some continued to sail for the rest of their lives. Arnall went on to own 2 commercial fishing vessels. Whenever he had a chance, he would tell anyone, neighborhood kids in Long Island, family, friends, strangers in bars, about the Zeta and its harrowing tale of wartime survival. Choate ran the National Boat Show in New York for 20 years. Jobson became a publishing executive and continued to sail, cruising and racing along the East Coast aboard his own boat, the Stormsvala, the Swedish name for a kind of storm petrel. The wartime experience also seemed to strengthen Weimer's love of sailing. "It didn't shake him up enough to get him off the ocean," his son Charles recently recalled. For the rest of his life, Weimer seemed to have a special connection to the ocean, and to rough waters in particular. He settled in Brightwaters, New York, just off the Great South Bay, and whenever a storm rolled in, he would sit and stare out to sea. The Zeta is still berthed in Greenport, where its owner takes it out every summer. The gray paint is gone, but its owner keeps the Coast Guard reserve number painted on the hull, and the boat has most of its original fittings. At 88, it is one of the few Hooligan vessels still sailing. During a recent overhaul, a rusty rifle bullet was found lodged in the ceiling, most likely trapped there when the boat was knocked over during the 1942 storm. It's now in a frame on the cabin wall, a reminder of the yacht's wartime service and astonishing ordeal. And that completes the article. Again, the title was The Sailboat and the Storm by David Woolman and Julian Smith. The next article is titled The Long Haul, How a Lively Market on Boston Harbor Became Known as the Cradle of Liberty by Michael Schneider. In 1740, when Boston was a colonial outpost of 16,500 people, an extravagantly wealthy merchant named Peter Faneuil offered his city a gift. to replace the informal scrum of vendors gathered at the city's docks, Faneuil proposed a modern marketplace to suit the ambitions of a growing city that, in just a few decades, would find itself hurtling toward revolution. The project had its share of detractors, so to get it built, Faneuil and his cohort of rich merchants had to steamroll smaller traders. It was an ironic beginning for a building that over the next 284 years would serve as a forum for practically every significant debate in American society, and even as a symbol for the tradition of public debate itself. Born in New York to a French family, Faneuil moved to Boston as a young man to apprentice with his uncle. Soon, Faneuil was expanding his family's fortune by trading high-quality New England cod for European luxury goods. He sent so-called refuse-grade fish to the Caribbean to feed the enslaved laborers who produced the molasses, sugar, and rum that returned to Boston on Faneuil's vessels. In 1742, the same year his hall was inaugurated, one of his ships, the Jolly Bachelor, sailed from Boston to Sierra Leone, returning with 20 kidnapped Africans. Faneuil lived just long enough to see his market completed, a squat red brick building, its ground floor dedicated to commerce with a public meeting hall upstairs and a golden dome on top. When Faneuil died a year later, the city hosted a lavish funeral in the new hall that bore his name. At the time, he held 5 enslaved people on his Boston estate. The hall hosted many defining moments of the colonial and revolutionary eras. During the 1760s, patriots met there to protest royal taxes, and in 1773, Samuel Adams initiated the Boston Tea Party from the hall's lectern. 4 years later, in the same room, George Washington made a toast to mark the one-year anniversary of the fateful shots that had launched the Revolutionary War. In the early 19th century, the city expanded the hall with a third floor and a Greek Revival-style market building next door, named for Mayor Josiah Quincy, built to contain the overflow of merchants. By then, Faneuil Hall was a fixture of American mythology and identity, says Eric Hansen Ploss, a public historian and National Park Service ranger, who ran the Faneuil Hall historic site from 2018 to 2021. Figures from every corner of politics have used the hall for events and rallies, amplifying the legend that this is where the idea of American liberty is born. Frederick Douglass argued here before packed houses of abolitionists in 1849 and 1858. That same year, Jefferson Davis, future leader of the Confederacy, gave a speech in what he called this sacred temple and invoked Samuel Adams himself in a dubious defense of Southern states' rights to conserve their slave economies. Suffragists and their opponents rallied here, as did protesters during the war in Vietnam. Segregationist George Wallace made a campaign stop here in 1972, and the following decade, LGBTQ activists held town halls to address the AIDS crisis in a heavily Catholic city. The building's commercial activity went into steep decline starting in the 1960s. Mayor Kevin White, who ran the city from 1968 through 1983, once described the view from his office in City Hall as a largely vacant and rodent-infested old public marketplace behind historic Faneuil Hall. The following decade, White partnered with commercial developers to transform the area into a leading example of the festival marketplace model, which privatized spaces in cities like Baltimore, Philadelphia, and New York. The Reverend John Gibbons, a Unitarian minister and activist who moved to Boston for college in the late 1960s, notes that as the neighborhood was sanitized, he says, the history was sanitized too. The faneuil of slave ships was replaced with the patriotic image of the man who founded the Cradle of Liberty, the moniker by which the Market Hall is still widely known. Faneuil Hall has since become one of the world's most visited tourist destinations, attracting as many as 18 million people each year. Today, in light of a national reckoning with the legacy of slavery and its ongoing implications for Black Americans, Gibbons has joined forces with clergy and activists to change the building's name entirely. For the Reverend Kevin Peterson, the Boston-born public theologian and Baptist minister who began the renaming campaign in 2018, Faneuil Hall serves as a metaphor, he says, a way to talk about race in a city whose deep historical ties to the slave trade have often been obscured by sunnier associations with the fight for independence. For all the arguments that renaming campaigns serve merely to whitewash history, activism has led to deeper inquiries into both Faneuil's and Boston's historical ties to the slave trade. Hanson Plass, the park ranger, began research in 2020 to uncover archival documents that corroborate Faneuil's participation in the slave trade. In June 2022, the city of Boston issued a formal apology for its role as a major port for enslaved Africans and singled out Peter Faneuil as a member of an oligarchical merchant class who bought and sold slaves as a matter of wealth building. At the end of that year, the city council established a task force on reparations to advise the mayor's office on social justice policy. The next year, an overwhelming majority of the city council voted in favor of renaming the building. It is not by mistake that we move from symbolically changing a name to "we're going to apologize for centuries of slavery" to the mayor naming a reparations task force, Peterson says. Boston's great public hall has yet to receive its new name. The machinery of democratic bureaucracy runs slowly. But once more, it is playing a central role in the politics of its era. Public buildings are not neutral, as Gibbons says. They speak of our values. They speak most eloquently, perhaps, when those values change. That completes the article. The title was The Long Haul by Michael Schneider. The last article is Sailing Against the Wind by Sonia Anderson. In 1901, the Canadian mariner John Voss set sail from British Columbia in a modified dugout canoe. He was headed for Australia seeking adventure and the world record for smallest vessel to circumnavigate the globe. Voss had found a sponsor and first mate in the thrill-seeking Canadian journalist Norman Luxton. Deciding a typical sealing schooner would be too easy, Voss purchased an indigenous whaling canoe carved by the Nuu-Chah-Nuth people on Vancouver Island, a 38-foot-long hollowed-out cedar trunk nicknamed the Tillicum, a Chinook word evoking the community. He outfitted it with sails and decking, and on May 21, 1901, Voss and Luxton set out for the South Pacific. Their only map was a one-sheet chart of the Pacific, and they had no proper chronometer. Voss couldn't even swim. It took 58 claustrophobic days to reach Fuji, and the captain was taciturn, almost surly. Luxton later wrote in an account of the voyage, "Soon after they'd reached Fuji, a depressed and fearful Luxton abandoned ship, but Voss simply found a new first mate and soldiered on. He had something about him, an aura of power and confidence," Luxton recalled. In the early 20th century, small vessels did not regularly sail very far offshore, says John M. McFarlane, curator emeritus of the Maritime Museum of British Columbia, and co-author of a 2019 book about Voss's exploits. When Tillicum's voyage ended in London, the canoe was displayed at Earl's Court, where audiences marveled at its slim body, its lack of guardrails, and the very idea that a small crew could have survived more than 3 years in it. Voss had earned the reputation of a madman. Even so, as McFarlane and co-author Lynn J. Salmon wrote, he proved a practical and confident mariner, not part of the mainstream of society, but rather an individualist, a survivor. That completes the article. The title was Sailing Against the Wind by Sonia Anderson. And that also ends the program today. This has been the Smithsonian Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your volunteer reader. I'm reading the January-February 2025 issue of the Smithsonian. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week. Keep listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. And if you missed a program you'd like to hear, such as the first half of the article I read today, go to the sunsounds.org website, click on the broadcast info and audio, then click on Demand Podcasts. You'll see a list of programs available. Hopefully, you'll find the one you're looking for. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.